Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Fred Niedner. It's session number 98-9 and is titled, Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Shape Our Stories. Let's listen in.
I think this is early, Thomas. 752.
By the Lord, sea and sky, I have heard my people cry.
Doing a practice a day out of the Practicing Our Faith book, which has been setting the theme of teaching sessions here all summer. Today's chapter is testimony, and for my alleged hilarity quotient, I brought along something that I normally wouldn't have brought along for Christian practices, but for the other kinds of things I am most often asked to talk about these days, people like myself have been invited for the last year or so, and extending into the next couple years, to talk almost exclusively about the end of the world. But with the millennium coming, you know, I can't tell you how many talks I've been asked to give on the Bible and the end times. And it's not even 1999 yet, so. I think this whole thing may dry up and blow away by 2000 because people will be so tired of hearing about it. Hopefully, that's my... Anyway, but I did bring along some of the humor I've been collecting for those talks. And I think that... I think that it's mildly appropriate today because I will get just a moment into the book of Daniel this morning, which does have some apocalyptic stuff in it, and so that's close enough to give an excuse. So what I brought along this morning are, you know about 666 being the number of the beast? Okay, well, what you may not know is that $665.95 is the retail price of the beast. And that the beast plus 5% sales tax comes out to $699.25. $769.95 is the price of the beast with all accessories, a replacement sold, and an extended warranty. $656.66 is the Walmart price of the beast. 00666 is the zip code of the beast. 1-900-666-0666. Live beasts. Call now. Over 18 only, please. Route 666 is the highway of the beast. 666K is the retirement plan of the beast. I-66686 is the CPU of the beast. 666I is the BMW of the beast. 668 is the next door neighbor of the beast. 666.5 is the upstairs apartment of the beast. And then people at a conference I was at earlier this summer suggested this one, 66.6 FM, Beast Rock. And then just earlier this morning, this will be obvious just by 666.org, the webpage of the Beast.
What's the temperature of the Beast?
Pardon me?
What's the temperature of the beast?
666 degrees Fahrenheit. I actually have that down here, oven temperature for roast beast. Okay. Well, testimony. It seems I start every morning by saying, that's a big subject. Every one of these conversations about these practices could be huge, and our words like testimony and witnessing, if you know, listen even with the slightest care, you can tell that's courtroom language. To give testimony is what you're asked to do in court, or to be a witness. But what we mean by that, at least in the Christian tradition, extends to a great many things that don't appear necessarily at all to be connected to a trial or to be asked for a deposition about things. Things as simple as telling the stories of the faith to our children are in a way giving testimony. Because of nothing else, we're preparing others for moments when they might be asked to give an account of their faith. And so one way or another, any telling of the story or shaping the message of how we have become a part of that story through what God has done to and for us, I mean, any of it could be considered testimony. This won't be a session at all on, a how-to do testimony. I gave the title to the announcements, people that some of you may have heard at breakfast, giving testimony, Christianity, or Christian witness under the cross or in your face. And that may sound just like, those people that come to your door hauled in on buses from some super fundamentalist church 15 miles from your home. But the issue of being under the cross or in your face is really an old set of issues. And so I want to give a little bit of a survey of the biblical period and look at the issues that surround the whole business of making testimony to the faith. And most of those issues have to do with public witness versus secret or private witness, given the circumstances of Israelites and the people in the early church. And a lot of the other issues have to do with choosing opportunities for making testimony and figuring out when is the right moment to make testimony. In the oldest times of the biblical period, testimony wasn't the kind of an issue that we would recognize in traditional societies as opposed to pluralistic societies. For example, there wasn't much in the way of what we would call missionary work going on. People switched religions primarily in ancient periods when their country or culture was conquered by somebody else, and obviously your god had lost, you went with the new gods. Go with the winners. Or if you were captured and forced. One of the few times in the older portions of the Old Testament, exilic and before, that the issue even arises is in one of those stories we read, if you were here in the last days, and talked about healing, stories like Naaman discovering that in Israel there was healing. Those people and their God, this enemy people, if you will, had something that our people don't. Or in Psalm 137, you have an expression of the difficulty of witness in the exile by the waters of Babylon. We hung up musical instruments, because how in the world could we sing the songs of Zion in that God-forsaken place? It just didn't seem to make sense. And so the best they could think to do was to pray that God would smash the heads of the enemy's babies. So testimony was very difficult, they thought, in that faraway place. The issues we would recognize as issues of testimony, I think, begin with the Hellenistic period of Israel's history, when they had lived through two centuries under the Persian culture that had released them from Babylonian captivity, and lived rather peaceably under the Persians. The Persians' theory of empire was that cultures should be left intact. And so they had actually even subsidized the Israelites' return from bondage in Babylon and go back home, set up your build your temple again and so forth. But then came Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Empire, which pursued his dream somewhat, his dream of bringing Hellenistic culture, Greek language, Greek art, Greek everything to the world as a blessing, which among other things might be able to relieve people of the need to be fighting all the time. Because if we didn't have so many languages and so many religions and so many of everything, maybe people would just quit whopping up on each other. If we just had one way of doing everything, we'd have peace. And so the Hellenistic culture wanted everybody to go Greek. Which, when you say it on a college campus, brings a certain kind of trouble. Anyway, the part of the empire that succeeded Alexander the Great, the so-called Seleucid dynasty, pursued to some extent that dream of making that part of the world live under Hellenistic culture, and ultimately banned the speaking of Hebrew, the use of Hebrew language, the obvious practice of any kind of the Jewish religion. And it was a very difficult thing to figure out for pious Jews how to respond to this. In a simplified way, the question was, do you go underground? Well, some people just capitulated, said, well, you know, what are you going to do? You can't fight the empire. So they simply capitulated and became Hellenized in every conceivable way. But a lot of Jews tried to go underground and practice the faith, but not in an obvious way. Others insisted that perverted and endangered the faith, and you have to be obvious about it. So they insisted on wearing the little signs above their foreheads and practicing the dietary restrictions and obviously using the Hebrew language and whatnot. At certain points during that period, they did this at great, great risk to themselves. And if you want to read what it was like to be a pious Jew in that period, and what they put up with in order to keep the culture alive by the theory of obvious observance, you can read, not in any of these Bibles that we have up here at Holden, but in a Bible that has the so-called Apocrypha, in it, you read 2 Maccabees, and you read the story of Eleazar and the seven brothers. Eleazar was an aged man, an elder of the Israelites, who was tied to a post, I think it was, in the middle of the town where he lived, and told, you will eat a bite of pork or else. And he refused. So they abused and tortured him to the point of doing things like gouging out his eyes and whatnot, and finally killed him because he would not, and they didn't want to do this. They begged him finally to please take one bite of pork, because this was looking pretty gruesome over one bite of pork. But no, he wouldn't. He would not budge one bit for them, and made testimony that he could not defy God's laws no matter what they wanted, and accept this bite of pork into his mouth. And so they beat him to death. And once the thing got started, neither he nor his captors could give in. The immediately subsequent story in 2 Maccabees is the story of seven brothers who are treated similarly, given the option of eating a bite of pork or being executed, and the story certainly isn't mealtime fare, and it's barely post-breakfast stuff. They killed each of these seven brothers in a different way. Boiled one in oil, skinned one alive, the old drawn quartering thing, and that kind of stuff, while their mother was forced to watch.
Okay.
All this, and then at the end of the story, she throws herself into the fire dies in the fire that had been used to heat up the oil to boil the one of her sons. But every one of these people in this story, and here's one of the major points, They make a long speech of testimony as they are about to endure their horrible death for the sake of the faith in which and in which they say we cannot give in to this kind of stuff. We follow the law of a God who we will obey over and above anything the Empire tells us. So that's what it was like, and that's what kind of testimony was being given by the Jews within that society, who believed the only way to respond to this situation is with obvious public resistance and the testimony that can go with that. Meanwhile, these other people were trying to keep it all underground. They translated the Bible into Greek so they could teach their children, you know, not have to ever teach their children Hebrew, but they could raise the children in Greek language, but the children could still learn the stories of Torah in Greek language. The people who were very public about it thought this an abomination. God does not speak that terrible Greek language of the pig eaters. How could you ever reduce the word of God to that heathen tongue? This was false testimony, they believed. So, how did you make the best sort of testimony of faithfulness in that kind of a circumstance? There were radically different views. A couple of books of the Bible come from this period and address this issue. The book of Daniel comes from the Hellenistic period. It's set as though it's in Babylon, which the kinds of issues that it talks about were never issues during the Babylonian captivity. They are the issues of the Hellenistic period, when Antiochus IV, who called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, you know, Antiochus God manifest, in effect demanded the worship of his subjects, and the Jews called him Antiochus Epimenes, Antiochus the madman, changing one little letter. It's a fun thing they would do. So Daniel, the book of Daniel addresses the issues of that period, and one of the famous stories that I know most of you learned already as children is the story of the three men in the fiery furnace. They made testimony by refusing to worship the great 60-cubit high golden statue of Nebuchadnezzar, and paid the price of being executed, thrown into the fiery furnace, and of course, you know the story. It ends up not just three, but the fourth fellow in the fiery furnace, and they survived this ordeal. And the powers of God are with them in this. So that's a story that, in effect, says, make a public stand against this kind of thing, and you will be, you will go through the fire for this, but you don't do it alone, and you will, the Jewish people will make it through this, you will survive. Daniel in the lion's den is sort of the same story. A person who resists the demands of the anti-Jewish culture ultimately is caught and again is delivered from the punishment. Those would seem to be stories which for the most part promote the obvious resistance, public resistance to what the Empire asks. There's another story which does something a bit more subtle and has a little different theory about what kind of testimony is appropriate under these circumstances, and that's the book of Esther, which I'll just tell you, or you know, talk about this story. I'm sure you know that one, and you don't need to actually be looking at the text. Esther is this Jewish woman in the court of the Persian king. So this story from the Hellenistic period comes from the Persian period and is set there. Excuse me, it comes from the Hellenistic period, but set in the Persian period. The king, or the Persian ruler, gets tired of his old wife or whatever, and chooses this new wife, Esther, who just happens to be a Jew. Only no one else knows it. In fact, this Jewish woman's name, Esther, is anybody here named Esther? Okay, I was going to ask if they knew what their name meant. That's a verb form, a first person singular Hebrew verb form from the verb which means to be hidden or to be a secret. So the name Esther means I am a secret. So she marries, this closet Jew marries the king. So we have a secret Jew in high places. And there's this public Jew in the story named Mordecai who has pretty much aggravated everybody because he's so upfront about his Jewishness. And this nasty fellow Haman has hatched a plot by which he means to have the Jews destroyed. And the way the story goes, the only way the Jewish people survived this plot is because the closet Jew, Esther, and the public Jew, Mordecai, are able to work together to expose and undo this plot. This story is actually in the canon because it's a festival scroll. It's used as a reading and even acted out as a melodrama, some of you may have seen, on the Festival of Purim, in which often children of a synagogue congregation will perform this, and the rest of the group sits with noisemakers and whatnot, and you boo and hiss the bad guy Haman, cheer Mordecai and Esther and so forth. And the point of the story is doing what's necessary for the survival of the people, of God's people, of the Jewish people. But the story doesn't work unless the closet faithful and the public faithful can find a way to work together. Which is finally what it took in 167 and following to overthrow the Hellenistic Empire. Something happened which we needn't go into here. The sacrifice of a pig on the altar in Jerusalem brought even the pacifists to the point of fighting, and they were able to overcome this empire. But the point here is that it doesn't always work to just do one thing, to have, you know, the obvious resistors or just the closet people. When they worked together, they could resist.
But Esther had to come out of the closet for that to work.
She ultimately did, but if she hadn't have been in the closet, she wouldn't have ever been.
She wouldn't have been in a position to do that.
That's right, yeah. The first obvious Christian story of this kind is the Gospel of Mark, where you have a secret person, a closet person. Mark tells the story of Jesus in such a way that he lives hiding his identity and talking in code so that no one catches on. In Mark's Gospel, as we've talked in a couple of other sessions this week, Jesus is baptized right at the beginning, named the Son of God, and then these demon-possessed characters try to expose his identity, and he silences them, which is part of a theme of his hiding that identity as a baptized one throughout, at least the first half of the Gospel. Mark 4 shows how far this secrecy extends. When the cycle of parables in Mark 4, pauses for a moment at verse 10. For the people to ask, what is the deal with all these parables? When Jesus was alone, those who were around him, along with the 12, asked him about the parables, and he said, to you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside, everything comes in parables, in order that they may indeed see but not perceive, and may indeed listen but not understand what we're talking about, lest they turn again and be forgiven. And that's a quote from the prophet Isaiah, but that's the purpose of the parables, to keep the insiders inside and the outsiders out. Is that what you thought parables were for? For keeping secrets? No, you learn as a kid that parables are for making things clear. But the way Mark tells this story, it's a piece of the code language. Well, this is how the early Christians lived. You know, Mark writes the story so that Jesus is a prototype, or at least this is a way to read Mark's gospel, so that Jesus is a prototype for people who hide their identity as baptized ones. Jesus finally has his moment of making testimony, right? When he's on trial and asked to give testimony, and for the most part he just stands there mute because he's following his own advice to say nothing but what the Spirit gives him. And the Spirit isn't making any speeches for him, except when he's finally asked, are you the Christ, Son of the Blessed, which is code for, are you a baptized one? Are you going to own up to that baptismal identity? And now he says, I am. And the rest of the gospel then is how to cope what they do to you when you say yes, which is to kill you. And he makes the testimony of his death, as I've already talked about. Well, probably not when many of you were here. The way Jesus dies in Mark, dying faithfully, is itself a great testimony in the way this gospel reads, because it induces the centurion in Mark's gospel to make the very confession that Jesus is dying for. Namely, the centurion is the first human being who isn't demon-possessed in the whole Gospel of Mark to confess Jesus is the Son of God. And that testimony, therefore, has huge impact. So there's a story of a secret person, secret believer, finding just the right moment for making testimony. So Mark's readers are bidden to live in whatever secrecy is necessary. But if you get caught, here's what to do. There's another issue in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount.
Before you go on, Fred, you said the question they ask translates, are you a baptized one? Can you say it a little bit more?
Well, the question they ask is, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?
How does that translate?
Well, if you ask that in the language of Mark's audience, that question is, are you a Christian? Are you baptized? Nobody else is going to be asked, are you the Christ? Other people are going to be asked, are you a Christ follower? Have you also been baptized? So, you know, Jesus as the prototype of the people who are going to face that trial is asked the question that inquires about those pieces of identity. The whole issue all through Mark's gospel is Son of God. That's the identity of his baptism.
What about the women running at the end?
Like I've had that presented about how that's kind of a question to the reader. I don't read her then, I don't know. But
what are you going to do?
Yeah, the women running away. What are you going to do? Are you going to run? Are you going to stand in testimony?
Yeah.
But in a sense, I hear you saying that maybe there's some consolence in the gospel for those who do provide.
No, I think that the ending of Mark's gospel, I do believe, is maybe I should explain this a little further so that everybody's aware of what this is about. The gospel of Mark ends in the most curious way. It's got these appendages, but the original gospel appears to end in chapter 16, verse 8. The young man says, "He's not here, he's risen. Go to Galilee, and you'll find him." And the women run away and say nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And then, because that seems such an inadequate ending, all kinds of people have added more. And so in footnotes, brackets, italics, or whatever, we've got three alternative endings. The so-called longer ending, in verses 9 to 20, in which they go around and drink poison and handle snakes and all that kind of stuff. The so-called freer ending, which is the longer ending with an extra addition that's in a manuscript that was once owned by some people named Freer. And then there's the very short ending that just says they went out and preached the imperishable gospel, and so on. But the authentic Mark ends, for better or worse, at 16:8. And maybe the rest was lost, or maybe Mark meant to end that way. And that's such a inadequate ending psychologically, because here is this story that Christians told to each other, and it ends with people afraid to talk. Something more needs to be said, and they all knew that if it had ended like that, they wouldn't be where they were. So most people understand that ending to be an inducement to tell the story. I've heard it as a psychological ploy that the reader is invited to comfort these women in the story with what they now know. The Gospel of Mark begins with the words, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ," and where does the beginning end? And some would say the beginning is the whole gospel up to 16:8, and the rest is what you say after that. Yeah. So one way or another, the story is frequently read as an inducement to testimony. Mostly what I've talked about so far are issues that are related to persecution and living in secret or living openly and making testimony in the middle of what in effect is a kind of a trial. A different set of issues appears in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount, which I'm going to suggest is related to testimony, the way you witness to your faith and to the gospel. Matthew 6, where we were yesterday for a moment talking about forgiveness because of the little note appended to the Our Father about you can't be forgiven if you're unforgiving. That chapter begins with this note: "Beware of practicing your piety before others in order to be seen by them, for then you have no reward from your Father in heaven." So, when you give alms, don't make a big public display out of it. Da 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 da. Arms. If you do that, and your point is for everybody to say, "Wow, what an alms giver," you'll get your reward. Everybody will say, "Wow, what an alms giver," and that's that. But if you want reward from your father, do it in secret, so your father who sees in secret will chalk it up to you. And when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who love to stand in public places and heap up words so that people will say, "My goodness, what a prayer." Don't do that. But when you pray, go in your closet and shut the door and pray to your Father who art in secret, so that your Father who sees and listens in secret will chalk it up to you. Verse 16, and when you fast, don't screw up your face and make everybody realize, "Oh, he's fasting again. How cool." But put on your makeup, wash your face. Don't let anybody know this is your secret that you're fasting. So there you have three pieces, probably not meant to be the only pieces, but three typical pieces of a thoroughly private discipline for practicing. It says piety in English. The word is dikaiosyne in Greek, which is the same word Paul uses for justification. And in some ways is even one of the words for salvation. This is practicing what it means to be God's people. You do this in secret. Don't let anybody know what you're doing. Which kind of makes you wonder about public worship. But now flip back to chapter 5. Verses 14 and following are what I want to look at for a moment. "You are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. A city built on a hill can't be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel, but on a lampstand. In the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." So there's a really public. Let the whole world see so that people glorify God. Now what, pray tell, is the relationship between those two things?
I think one thing it says is that you, for other people to see, you're not necessarily telling people the good things you're doing, you're just doing it, and other people are looking at it, versus the almsgivers who are saying, "By the way, here I am." Mm-hmm. You know, where you're, I think it's a difference of drawing attention to yourself, or just having other people recognize that that's who you are.
And also the first, the almsgiving and the fasting and praying, is a personal relationship between me and God. And that doesn't have anything to do with anybody else unless I want people to think I'm so pious. But the other is my work in the world and how I am with my community and how I live among my fellow human beings. And I think that gives glory to God, by the way, that it's a different relationship.
Yep.
Doing useful things.
So one of the major distinctions here is the difference between the private practice of piety and the public doing of things that are called good works here. And I would say even that there's a relationship between the two, that the private practice of piety is what enables doing these other things. But there's a secret in this, these other things too. There's going to have to be a secret here if what's going to come from these is something other than, "Wow, aren't you a good worker?" But people saying, "Thank God." The trick is to figure out a way to live by practicing your piety so that you can pull off this very difficult thing, that you can do things that leave people thanking God instead of you. Mm-hmm. An analogy I like to use, just this is a personal story, but I think it kind of makes the point, or part of the point. I have no idea what discipline or piety or anything else triggered this, but one time many years ago, I got an anonymous card. I mean, I got an unsigned card in the mail with no return address, just a greeting card, a really cheap one. You couldn't even buy this at a Hallmark shop. You'd have to get it at a Dollar General store or something like that. And inside of it was five $20 bills. And I never, ever figured out who did that. And back then, there was a lot of money, grad school days. I never figured it out. And I didn't even spend it for a while because it was so mysterious. I just kept looking in there, see if I was really in there. You know, and it seemed odd to spend it on silly things or regular things, you know. But all I could do was thank God. Because I never figured, I didn't know who else to thank. It was just one of these, it was like it was out of the blue, literally. Now, we're not practiced at that. I almost everything I give away, the IRS knows about. You know, so I'm getting credit for this in one way. But
you're not getting praise for what you give away, tell the IRS for.
Well, sometimes I do. You know, I get my name on donors' lists. You know, even Holden Village publishes a donor list now, so that you get some names of people who do things for the village. And my university publishes a donor list. You know, because people like to see their names in print, you know, having given $100. You know, and I don't know about...
They divide you up in little groups according to how much you need.
And we, you know, this is standard practice. I am not trying to knock this. This is how human beings are. We have giving clubs. You know, and you're in this category, that category, and when you get your addition from your place that you get to that has all those thousands of names in, do you look for your name? I do. Yeah, that's human nature. So this is something that really flies in the face of human nature, to practice a piety that allows you to do things that leave people thanking God. So this is a way to give testimony that's got this amazing quality that you figure out a way to do it so that it's not about you. It's glory to God that we're trying to have happen. So there's another issue of testimony. Who's it about? And I think we always need to be asking, when we're giving testimony of any kind, bearing witness to our faith, whether we're doing, is this about me? And am I being with another person, sharing the stuff of the faith, for something that's really my agenda? It's a difficult set of questions in some ways.
That's very helpful, though, because for those of us who go the other way and don't want to say anything for fear of trying to, of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, or turning somebody off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a card, postcard up in the bookstore that you can buy. And it says on one side, it's a saying of Francis of Assisi, proclaim the gospel always, if necessary, use words.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know the context of that. Why? What exactly? What conversation that comes in the midst of? Some of us who are word lovers and word people, that's a hard saying. But anyway, there is that other kind of proclamation and testimony that is part of what Matthew's doing here. Well, there are plenty of other issues. I want to save a few minutes for conversation because I have been remiss about that much of the 2 weeks I've been doing this. But there are plenty of very public, extended pieces of testimony in the book of Acts. Lots of sermons by the, by Peter, by a couple of them by Paul. Maybe the most notable of all is the testimony of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, we call him. And martyr is the Greek word for a witness at a trial. He's a person who made testimony and got him killed. Now, this is not totally serious, but he did make some mistakes. If you read Stephen's sermon in Acts 6 and 7, he preached the whole Bible. He started at Genesis and finished at the end, And they tell you in homiletics class, don't preach the whole Bible in one sermon. But I don't think they stoned him for that. I think they stoned him for the accusations he leveled against him. There's another issue that is kind of late at this point to start doing a serious study of, but what sort of tone do you take when you make testimony? Most of the sermons in the book of Acts are dreadfully accusatory. Is that a winsome way to preach? It got most of them chased out of town, stoned, a couple of them killed, etc. But of course Luke's point was that this is the story of Gentile growth and all the accusations are leveled against Jews. That was the effect. It made the Gentile church grow. So the tone and the nature of your testimony is also an issue. I'm gonna let us spend the rest of the time on whatever we want.
I was just curious about in chapter 10 in Matthew, verse 32, it says, "Everyone therefore who acknowledges me before others, I also will acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies me before others, I will also deny." What does that verb acknowledge? Any ideas about what that, either how that fits into the earlier conversation about public and private?
Well, I think that's another persecution thing.
Mm-hmm.
Basically this is, I would put this as being parallel to that message in Mark's gospel that when it, be as secretive as you want to, but when you're finally asked, when your moment of trial comes and you're finally asked, are you one of them? You acknowledge you are, but and the antitype is Peter, who denied. Of course, though, there is forgiveness. If you want to really mystify yourself and dive into the profundity of all this, there's a wonderful novel by a Japanese Christian who just died a year and a half ago named Shusaku Endo, E-N-D-O, and the name of the novel is Silence. And it's a novel about testimony and martyrdom, making witness. And I love to do things where we read the Gospel of Mark and then read Chisaku Endo's Silence. It's the story of a 17th century Japanese, that's a Portuguese missionary to Japan, who happens to be in Japan at the time when Japan decides that they will no longer tolerate Christian missionaries, and so they are arresting Christian missionaries and trying to get them to apostatize. And the method, the primary method for doing this, is, which is worked out on the major character in this story, is they take his followers or his congregants, the members of his Christian community, and they hang them upside down over pits of dung and stuff like that, or seawater, and gradually lower them just in very tiny increments at a time until they will ultimately drown in whatever it is they have them hanging over. And the only way they will release these congregants is if the priest and missionary will deny Christ by stomping on a piece of art that's got the face of Christ on it, and thus cursing Christ. You know, which would be the equivalent of Peter denying, you know, and so here's this priest trying to figure out what is the testimony that you make and what do you do here in this situation? Do I let my, again, and they'll let him go. Either way, they're going to let him go. So he can be free with his integrity, having made witness that he would not deny Christ at the cost of all of their lives. Or he can be free having denied and saving them too. So what should you do?
You should ostensibly do it. And just, I mean, does it have to be, if you step on the Lord, does that necessarily mean that you're intently denying Christ? Or just,
well, that would be one argument. One argument was, hey, just let them think whatever they want to think. You know, just step on it and then go about your merry way. And there's one guy in the story who keeps doing that. He's the Judas character. And he keeps telling this priest, you know, what's the big deal, you know? And he keeps showing up. He keeps going through the same deal and keeps showing up. But he's, you know, is that integrity? You know, finally nobody knows what he believes. But the crux of the story, or the crucial moment of the story, the climax of the story is, he's got like one last chance. The congregants are up to here, you know, upside down in the stuff, and they're about to die. And he's faced with this, and at the crucial moment, all of a sudden the face on the floor speaks to him and says, trample, trample. This is what I came for. Mm-hmm. It was to be trampled by human beings that I became one of you. Trample.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, so it isn't up to us to save the world. That's Christ's job in the Christian faith. Mm. So there's another issue of testimony. Mm-hmm. Whose integrity and whose saving work finally does the ultimate saving thing, you know? So. It's a wonderful novel, but it's not entertainment. Well, the bell has come, so I guess we're done. Thank you very much.